Outlet Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome along to The Profile today with myself, Justin Brierley, here on Premier Christian Radio. And it's always a delight to be joined by a friend on The Profile today. It's Patrick Forbes. But before we meet him, just a reminder that you can find The Profile on its own podcast at premierchristianradio.com/The Profile. And it's brought to you each week in partnership with Premier Christianity Magazine. And if you'd like a free sample copy of the latest edition of the magazine, you can go to their website as well. That's premierchristianity.com/free sample. A Room Full of Elephants. That's the autobiography of Patrick Forbes. My first 80 years in the church. Patrick Forbes is a priest, a broadcaster, and a clown. We'll hear all about that. And Patrick has been a much-loved voice for many years for listeners on Premier Christian Radio. He's presented some 700 editions of Traveller's Tales and many, many thoughts of the day along the way as well. And we've known each other for probably pretty much all of my broadcasting career, that's for sure. Patrick, welcome along to The Profile. How are you doing?
Thank you very much, Justin. I'm fine. It's all the others.
This is a real treat for me because I don't always get to interview people that I actually know, at least personally at some level. And gosh, the legend of Patrick Forbes goes back a long way. But in reading the book, I understood who you are sort of in a fuller way.
Well, if you found out who I am, could you tell me, please? That would be great help.
We'll come to the title of the book in a moment's time. What I've always wanted to do this to you, though, because you've done it to so many other people, which is start with the same question you often have begun Traveller's Tales with, which is tell us about life growing up and when you first bumped into God.
Well, almost the nearest thing, I guess, was my great uncle, John. He was a vicar in Herefordshire and at a little tiny village called Muchdew Church. And I think because I was born just before the war, the Second World War, my parents probably thought I might be a little bit safer in Herefordshire than in London. And so I spent some months there, I guess. And I was very, very little, probably only between one and two. And he had a great bushy beard, did my great uncle John. And we called him the Boncle Man, which was sort of a corruption of the French L'Oncle Jean. And I probably couldn't say L'Oncle Jean, so Boncle Man did. And he was a bachelor and he had a slightly scary Welsh housekeeper called Mrs. Taylor. And Mrs. Taylor made for my great uncle John a milk pudding every day for his lunch, which is why I can't look a milk pudding in the face now. But he would allow me to sit on his knee and watch him fill his pipe in his tip of a study. Actually, I think that's probably where I learned how to make a tip out of a study, looking around me here. I'm still working on it, trying to clear it up. Anyway, I definitely was baptized there. And I think probably by my grandfather on my mother's side, who I never sort of actually met to talk to. He became Provost of Aberdeen, and he apparently was offered the job of being Bishop of Aberdeen, and his wife said, if you accept that, I'm leaving you. So for hundreds of years on my mother's side, there's always been a priest or minister in the family, but I suppose I'd have been baptized there, but it wasn't an encounter with God in the way that you're probably asking. After that, I guess I was taking the church in Burford, where we stayed in a friend of my mother's house for the duration of the war. And I was taken to St. John the Baptist in Burford, which is a very fine church. And if I didn't go to church, I wasn't allowed to get a choice of comics after the service. So, of course, I was a very, disciplined attendant, as you can imagine. But I didn't know about how to behave in church. I'm not sure I do now, really. And a voice was heard during one of the vicar's sermons one Sunday. I know where he got that. It was from Lift Up Your Hearts. on the wireless.
Oh, wonderful.
There's my first sort of evidence of interest in religious broadcasting and
there you
church,
go.
I guess.
That's great. And I'm sure the same goes today. Many pastors and vicars still steal things from the radio hear.
Yes.
Tell us about this book then, A Room Full of Elephants. It's your autobiography, really. And I mean, how do you compact 80 years plus into so many pages? What's, you know, and how do you have the recall as well? Did you keep a diary or something? Because
no.
I'm amazed at the memory that you seem to exhibit in the book.
It's very interesting, this, because I've always characterized my memory as being full of things that didn't matter a scrap. You know, like the gross registered tonnage of the first ship I worked on as a radio officer, 8,617.23 tons.
Wow.
Or the average thickness of electrical transformer laminations, you know, and all the things that should be there, like a good grasp of theology, how to behave, and common courtesies and so on, there's probably no room for them, because it's already full up with nonsense songs and, you know, dull things like that. But as to how I came to write it, I retired sort of ill in the round about 1998, something like that. I had something called, it was discovered subsequently, I had something called hemochromatosis, which is where the body doesn't process iron or metabolize iron. So it builds up in joints and eventually kills you if you're not diagnosed with it. And these symptoms for me working for the Mission of the Seafarers in the late 1990s was that the church we worked in, the offices in London, in a Wren church near Candle Street, St. Michael Paternoster Royal. And we were in the tower and my office was on the third floor. There was no lift except for stationary. And I couldn't squeeze in. I thought about it once or twice. And when I went to this job, I could run up those stairs, no trouble at all. But my last 18 months, I could barely stagger up those stairs and I couldn't think why it was. Maybe we'll come to it later in the story, you know.
Mm.
But I suppose I've had all this time in inverted commas retirement, which I don't think actually is true for the clergy. They don't retire.
No.
You know, they bore people to death or bore themselves to death, I think. And so I began to think about writing another book. I'd written a book about clowns and fools and gospel in 1988, I think it was, and co-wrote two books, one about clowning in church and one a sort of comic book about the church as a stocking filler for Gerald's publishers in Norwich. But I'd co-written those two books. So I thought, right, I'll have one more book. And I wasn't sure what to write about, really. And I wrote about half a book. And thought, no, this is all wrong. What am I doing? So dunked all that and started again. And by this time, I'd had more time, if you like, to sort of observe the weird activities of the Church of England. And I thought, well, A Room Full of Elephants might be, you know, I might write some of that down.
Mm.
And it really only sort of comes up in the last chapter, really, when I have one or two wild ideas about what's going on, what's going wrong, what we might do about it. But you know, if anyone gets slightly weary reading the book, they should thank God that actually the publisher said, this is just too long. You know, would you be happy for someone to sort of edit it, you know, and sort of cut it down size? I said, absolutely. So a very nice sort of cousin second times removed, or I don't know, something like that. The daughter of a cousin of mine who works as a reader in the Church of England, she took it on herself to edit it, and she took about 25,000 words out. Okay. So
yeah.
I put about 5,000 or 7,000 words back, probably the same one. And she did cut a lot of the family stuff. She said, you want to know who you need to know who you're writing this for.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a good question. It's
yes.
like, you know, what's the point of this interview?
Yes.
Discuss.
Yes.
So it is shorter than it turned out.
Yeah. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed reading it and getting a bit more of a background on the many different things you've done, such as finding out that you, you know, in your early years worked on trawler fishing boats and then, you know, ocean going vessels. And this was all part of an early career you had as someone operating the radios and so on board ships and things. What was that life like? I mean, quite well, salty sea dogs and so on that you were sailing with. It was probably a world away from the parish ministry you later ended up in.
Absolutely. But enormous fun. I mean, it was, if you like, it was a sort of unofficial university education where I, instead of having to pay fees, I got paid about £1 a day when I first went to sea. And it all happened because a guy who wasn't necessarily a great friend of mine came up to me my last day at school, last week in school or so, or last term in school, 1956, to say, "Patrick, how would you like to spend 3 weeks on a trawler out of Grimsby in August?" And I, as I tend to do, I said yes, without giving it a second thought. I thought, what fun, you know.
That's how your life has gone, it appears, by saying yes to people without really thinking through the consequences.
Exactly. Yeah. And particularly not asking what the consequences might be. And that was, you know, when we had spent 3 weeks on this trawler, which had a very interesting wartime history, in fact, before being wrecked off the coast of Iceland after I'd left it. And going up the east coast of probably Scotland, skipper suddenly said, you know, not to me in particular, he said, I can't get the radio telephone to work. And because I was sort of a bit of, you know, I'd started building amplifiers and things like that and tape recorders and things, I said, you know, shall I have a go? You know, and he said, yes, here's the instruction book, get on with it. And I made it work. And at the end of the trip, the guy in charge of radio for that fleet of trawlers said, if you want to go and train as a radio operator, we'll give you a job. And I, you know, never thought about that before and didn't think about it for very long. I mean, I was sort of hoping to be some sort of journalist like my mother eventually. So I said, yeah, right. So I went on a course and found myself in the Merchant Navy.
Yeah. And learned the now perhaps lost art of Morse code and all the rest of it.
I can still read it at 25 words a minute.
Amazing, amazing.
And it's radio amateurs use it. And because everything's gone digital and with satellites and things, it's all very fine so long as everything works.
Yes, exactly. But there, who knows, there may be a point when we need to call up Patrick Forbes because we can only using Morse code.
Yeah.
And then, of course, one fascinating thing was that it was actually on a transatlantic boat that you were sort of helping with, that the idea was first put to you of priesthood, which had never entered your mind, really, at that point, had
it? Absolutely not.
Tell us the story of who suggested this to you.
Well, I was working most of the time in the Merchant Navy. For your first 6 months, you have to do 6 months on a two-operator ship, so you don't, you know, caused the world to collapse in your first 6 months. And then I worked on Tate and Lyle's bulk sugar carriers, which was like a bus service, really, going down to, you know, it's idyllic, really, thinking back. I mean, apart from the weather and sometimes the food. The, you know, we were down in the Caribbean about every 6, 7, or 8 weeks, loading 4,000 or 5,000 tons of sugar and bringing it back to this country. Wow. So I'm responsible for vast swathes of tooth decay in the, you know, in the population. And occasionally we took out guests of the company. There was, you know, the odd cabin spare. And we took a USPG missionary called Robert Nind, N-I-N-D. And we took him out to a parish in Jamaica. And on subsequent trips, I had a word with the chief steward to see if we could make up some food parcels for him of typically English foods, like, you know, Cooper's Oxford marmalade or Kellogg's cornflakes, which would have been available in Jamaica, but you'd have had to pay an awful price for them because they'd have been exported all the way from this country. And before I finished with Tate and Lyle's ships and before I came ashore, I one day got an airmail from him, and in the course of which he said, course of lots of other stuff, he said, I look forward to one day to seeing your name amongst those to be ordained in the Church of England. I mean, this was as weird as someone coming up to me and saying, how do you like to spend 3 weeks on the trawler? And you know now what how things happen.
Yes.
And I'd never thought about this in my life, you know.
Wow.
And
there you go.
Anyway, I came ashore to do a first class license and stayed with some fellow students in Wandsworth and studied at Norwood Technical College in South London. One day, one of my fellow students, who was madly in love with a young maiden, said to me, how would you like to make up a foursome? My girlfriend is staying with somebody called Annette, and it'd be great to go on the student union dance down at Lambeth Town Hall in Brixton. So, of course, I said yes, you know. And I hid my 15 quid Austin 7 round the corner from from her house because I'd crashed it about 6 weeks earlier on a 1-in-6 hill. It still had grass growing out of the roof. And I thought, if her father sees this, he's not going to let his daughter out in this any more than I would. Anyway, he said, you must be back at 11 o'clock, you know, on the dot.
Mm-hmm.
And so off we went to the dance, which was awful. And one of the other guys said, I tell you what, we know a very nice place for coffee. So we left the dance, and this nice place for coffee, it was in Richmond, which is, you know, from Austin 7, a day's journey right across South London. And we just got into this nice coffee bar by the river, and time for one coffee, and it was time to go all the way back to South London, to up and onward to deliver, safely deliver my girlfriend, or Annette, my partner for the evening. And going across Wandsworth Common, the engine sort of died and the lights went out. And I got out and rummaged around in under the bonnet and made it all work. And we got there 3 minutes after 11 o'clock. And that was the beginning of all kinds of things. And I, you know, clearly Annette was the girl for me.
Mm.
And we sort of got together. And while I was still studying, went to church at her local church in Norwood. And people started saying to me, you know, you ought to get yourself ordained. I thought, oh, God, here we go again. What is going on here? Anyway, I went back to see, and it was clear we were going to get engaged and get married. But it was also clear that Annette wasn't going to get married to a sailor.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that. I'm surprised any marriages survive people being away at sea for long periods of time. And so that was
was how it all began. And Annette, you know, oh gosh, how many years have you been married now, Patrick?
Hang on, what's 59 years this Wednesday?
There you go. Gosh, well, that'll be lovely to celebrate.
So the Queen's got to stay alive until next year, so she can send me a card on our 60th.
Absolutely. I mean, and in a way, though, the sailing has stayed with you. You've loved to go sailing on smaller boats in the intervening years. That you tell a few stories of scrapes you've had in the book with various boats of various kinds.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll you know, if we've got time, we'll get to some of that later on. But you were evidently very technically minded. You sort of were good with transistors and, you know, bits of kit.
Actually, I don't like transistors.
Oh,
I like comforting valves with which glow, and then you know they're going to be all right. Transistors just lie there all inert and dare you to imagine what's wrong with them.
Anyway, you were quite technically gifted, and in a sense you understood the mechanics of these things. In fact, one of your early jobs after meeting Annette and was sort of in a sort of recording studio, wasn't it, and doing bits and pieces.
I had a wonderful job which I mean, I had two jobs when I came ashore. One was with a telephone answering machine company, and I couldn't understand why I was I'd applied for a job sent by from the Labour Exchange, a job as a bench fitter, £8.10 or £8.50 a week, £8.10 it would have been then. And the guy kept asking me weird questions. Mr. Matthews, he said, do you like meeting people? Do you like travelling? What's all this to do with being a bench fitter? So I walked out of that with a £15.10 a week job as a installation and service engineer. Of course, there was a catch. I was the only the second such person for the whole of the United Kingdom.
Oh, gosh.
And in 14 months, I drove 34,000 miles. And that was just the driving. It wasn't dealing with enraged customers whose machine had fallen in love with another machine and stopped, you know, kept the lines busy. But then I got this lovely job in a recording studio.
Yes, and there's a great story about you recording the sound effects for some newfangled device that would play
the Mellotron.
Yes, sound effects.
God, yes,
which
I'm glad we never had to do
by more modern technology in terms of synthesizers and things. But but at the time, this was cutting edge. And you tell us the story of when you had to sort of rescue a production of Oh, What a Lovely War.
Yes. Well, Oh, What a Lovely War was a fantastic show. And having said, I say that without having actually seen it, but I'm told it's wonderful. But it's heavily dependent, massively dependent on sound effects. So our studio got the job of constructing, designing and building and installing a completely idiot, fail-safe, you know, system. And we butchered three Ferrograph tape machines. And the chief engineer at IBC Studios designed this system whereby you had three lots of tapes, all with the same sound effects going on. But in between each sound effect, there was a foil, piece of foil tape.
Mm.
And there was a micro switch, which when it was told to by the tape, if one or other was behind, it would bring them all up to the same space and then they'd start off again, you know.
Mm.
So it was wonderful. And I was on standby duty during one evening at the studio because there was a big session on in one of the studios. And I got this panic call from the Lyric Theatre, I think it was, saying, the system's failed. Can you come down? The theatre's filling up, you know. So I jumped in a taxi with a toolkit and went down to the theatre and everyone was panicking. And the one thing I learned at IBC Studios was don't panic. I just asked everyone to just vanish, you know, and just leave me some space and quiet to sort it. And which I did. And they got away, you know, they got on stage on time. It opened at the right. And nobody would have had a clue that there was, had been any problem at all. I can't remember even what the fault was. It doesn't matter. But anyway, sort of saved the day.
Yes.
I thought, wouldn't it be nice if they gave me a ticket to see the show, which they didn't?
Oh, well.
I'll see it one day.
Yes, there's maybe still time.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all, you know, preemptive, really, of your career in broadcasting, which also involved inevitably, as it does for most broadcasters who are working, you know, at the grindstone, some technical, you know, close shaves and that sort of thing. But we'll come to that. I first of all want to talk about, you know, when did you finally answer this nagging, persistent call to priesthood? And what did that look like as you started to train and, you know, with a family as well.
We've talked a little bit about the studio, which was so enjoyable. When I went for the interview, I felt obliged to say to the interviewing panel there that there was an outside chance that I might be accepted for training, you know, for ordination. And they either didn't hear me say that or they thought it was so fanciful it would never happen. But, you know, I got involved with the church where Annette and I were married, which was her church. And the vicar there was a lovely, lovely man called Michael Percival Smith. And I'm sure he probably encouraged me. And I thought, well, you know, I'll fill up all the paperwork and send it up to Church House. And I had to list my academic qualifications, which were very few. I mean, I'd done only six O-levels. I'd got fed up with school and left before A-levels and had gone to sea. And anyway, I put in what I'd done and so on. I wish I'd kept it. I got a funny letter from them saying, "Dear Mr. Forbes, try as we might, we've been unable to assess your academic, your technical qualifications in academic terms." So I thought, well, yes, fine. And so what, you know, anyway, I went off to a selection. In those days, I mean, today, if you think you're called to the ministry in the Church of England, the number of people you have to see and probably the paperwork you have to do is unbelievable. I didn't see anyone except my bishop, who was the Bishop of Croydon, a guy called John Taylor Hughes, who saw me at his club, gentleman's club, somewhere off Trafalgar Square, Northumberland Avenue, I think it was. And I cannot for the life of me remember what we talked about. And that was it, you know.
That was it, yeah.
I got sent to a selection conference.
There you go.
Which was weird.
I'm sure.
It was very strange.
For some strange reason, they let you through, Patrick.
Yeah, yeah.
And...
yes, because one of the selectors went ill before he got to me, I'm sure of that.
Yeah, there's a great story of this sort of slightly scary personality who fortunately
military man, I think.
wasn't around by the time you were being grilled. But I mean, this led on obviously to training and so on. You struggled initially to find a college, didn't you? But you did find one eventually.
They didn't seem to, colleges I've applied for seemed terribly keen to have graduates, you know, proper people. So the first place I tried, Cuddesdon, where the principal was Robert Runcie.
Who you would go on to work under later on.
Yes, much later on. And I was never quite sure if he remembered. He turned me down. He said, you probably know it's only in very rare cases do we accept non-graduates. So I suggest you try Chichester. So I went back furious about this, you know, because, you know, every journey in a 1929 Austin 7 was epic and an achievement. You know, they should have let me in just on, you know, the fact that I'd got there. Anyway, the next place was Westcott House, frightfully nice place in where my vicar had trained and one of his curates too. Westcott House in Cambridge. So we got an interview there and the college knew in advance because I told them that Annette and I would be staying with friends in Cambridge. And while I was allowed in for interview to see round play, Annette was never asked. And the strange man in charge, a guy called Peter Walker, who went on to become a bishop, many of them do, he said, you probably know that supposing we were to offer you a place, you'd have to live apart from your wife for your first year. I told him exactly what he could do with that and left. But finally, we found a place that welcomed the marriage state and made provision for it at Lincoln with Alan Webster, who became Dean of St. Paul's and Dean of Norwich. Absolutely splendid person.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think things have changed significantly since those days in the Church of England? Is there still an emphasis on you have to have a specific type of education and that sort of thing? Or do you think it's a bit easier for people?
The joke was on the Church of England in so many ways, because at the end of my 2 years at Lincoln, I had done all the examinations, 13 examination papers, and wrote to my bishop as courtesy required that I should, to ask him permission to leave and to go to parish. He wrote back and said, no, you're a non-graduate. You must stay there for another year. So I wrote back and said, actually, there isn't a 3-year course here. Do you really want me to sit through all that awful stuff again? You know, so he compromised and said, all right, well, you can go in 3 months and be ordained at Advent. Just use your 3 months to do some reading, which was lovely. I don't suppose I read any theology for those 3 months. I caught up on sort of real literature.
The normal world, yes. Yeah.
Well, look, you asked about how different it might be now.
Yes.
I don't really know. I do think there's been a terrible shift in the sense that now, in those days, you had to go and do two jobs as a curate somewhere.
Mm.
Now you just do one.
Right.
And I think that's a huge error of judgment, because the shock of going from theological college or even a theological course to into a parish.
Yes.
I would judge that you still need quite a long time. I was about eight years probably.
Yeah.
And you, idiot curate.
Well, we'll talk about being dropped in the deep end of parish ministry in the next section of the programme. You're listening to, I was about to say Traveller's Tales, but that would not be true.
Because
it's a very similar sort of feel today on the show. It's The Profile, but it's with Patrick Forbes, who has, of course, on Premier Christian Radio, presented Traveller's Tales for many years, some 700 episodes of that. And we'll talk about your broadcasting career in the next section of the show, Patrick. But we're talking about My First 80 Years in the Church is the subtitle of Patrick's new book, A Room Full of Elephants. It's the story of his life, his ministry, and indeed some of the unusual things that he's done, including clowning, which I want to get to as well, Patrick, in the course of today's show. So do join us again on the other half of a quick break. We'll be back very shortly.
Holier than thou.
Radical.
Delusional.
Ignorant.
Perfect. It's time to challenge stereotypes about Christians, and Premier Christianity is leading the way.
Transform your perceptions, broaden your horizons, open your mind to wide-ranging views.
Read interviews with politicians, theologians, and TV presenters.
Discover the breadth of the Christian spectrum.
Be provoked, react, inspired, and informed. Get the print magazine and full online access for just £4.95 a month. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com.
Premier Christianity Magazine.
The bigger picture.
The Profile.
You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of this week's edition of The Profile. I'm Justin Briley, and I'm joined this week by Patrick Forbes, priest, broadcaster and clown. Before we continue talking about his new autobiography, A Room Full of Elephants, just a reminder that you can find today's profile as a podcast at premierchristianradio.com/theprofile. And the podcast is brought to you every week in partnership with Premier Christianity Magazine. So if you'd like a free sample copy of the latest edition of the mag, do go to their website at premierchristianity.com/free sample. Patrick Forbes, we were just coming to the point where you had been ordained, and we're going to have to skip some elements of this for the sake of time. But a pretty significant place that you ministered was Thamesmead. Just tell us a little bit about Thamesmead, because it was in a way a fairly new sort of place, wasn't it? And you were developing a fairly new kind of ministry there in some ways.
Well, it was a huge area of ground on the south bank of the Thames below Woolwich, between Woolwich and Erith, the Plumstead and Erith marshes, including some Woolwich Arsenal Ministry of Defence ground. And the GLC and Greenwich and Bexley boroughs were developing this as a town of the 21st century for 60,000 people, mostly being moved out of from slum clearance, mostly again in the East End of London, which got so heavily blitzed. And I'd been working just for about 2.5 years or so in Somerset, which was very sleepy and hugely overchurched, I reckoned. And so I wrote to Southwark Diocese and said, have you got any interesting jobs going? And Bishop John Robinson got in touch and said, well, there's this parish at Kidbrook I'd like you to go and see. So up we came to look at Kidbrook. And we were not hugely impressed, because when we asked the church warden where our tiny son of about 18 months might you know, sleep, oh, he said, I think the last baby slept in his pram in the hall. Well, we thought that was not too welcoming, so we asked John Robinson if there anything else we could look at before we drove back to Somerset, and he said, have a look at Thamesmead and the Abbey Wood estate. And so we trolled down there, and the Abbey Wood estate had been there, I think, about 10 years it's about an estate for about 10,000 people. And Thamesmead was going to eventually surround it more or less on three sides. And Thamesmead was just a massive building site. And so we opted for Thamesmead.
and spent a fruitful time. In
9 years. 9 years. We arrived with the first 20 families and left, I think, when there were about 17,000 people there.
Gosh.
And the fabulous thing was that the Bishop of Woolwich, probably was his boss, the Bishop of Southwark, had knocked all manner of church heads together and said, let us work cooperatively. Let us plan cooperatively to work and witness together at Thamesmead. So he'd got the Anglican Church, the Methodist Church, the Roman Catholic Church, the United Reformed Church, i.e. Presbyterian and Congregationalists, and all to work together. The people who wouldn't work with us were the Baptists, alas, which I think was a terrible shame.
Mm.
Anyway, so we moved there for Coraline Walk. They've pulled it down now, I think, which is a shame. Mm. Very nice flat. And I was also involved on the Abbey Wood estate because the vicar there left. So I was sort of nominally, notionally in charge. And the beginnings of Thamesmead.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have missed it for anything. I really would not. It was just one of those marvellous places, which if you'd really thought very hard about it, you'd probably said no to.
Mm.
And I met recently one of the guys there who's an Anglican priest. And he's been told by priests that, you know, when they hear that he works at Thamesmead, they say, how on earth could you go and work there?
Mm.
Yeah, you know, gosh. People have been put off going to work there.
Yeah.
But it was one of the most stimulating and demanding places I've ever been in my life.
Yes.
And what was so much fun was because there's no history, tradition, we had to invent history
yes.
and tradition very, very quickly. And my role eventually became sort of when the team was established, which was some years after I got there, had to be legally established, you see, ecumenical team. I was made up to team vicar responsible for community development, which was a dream job because it was, I'd call it a ministry of mad ideas.
Yes.
And so what did we need to start with? We needed a means of people knowing what on earth was there. So I started a sort of awful community newspaper, which somebody said, this is so awful, we'll offer to print it for you and it will look better immediately, which was great. And that I looked after that for about, well, till I left, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Thamesmead Insight. And you know, helping playgroups to form, helping the community association to be born, working with other caring professions like social services, like the health services, education, the police. We've helped form something called the Community Workers Group, where all of these people who were getting ground down by the sheer massive volume of need there, because people were moving from comfortable, if slightly grim housing in friendly areas with cheap street markets and jobs, into a place which was Parker Morris standard council housing, and therefore rents to match. And there's been huge redundancies in the Woolwich area due to AEI being taken over and asset stripped. You know, no street markets near them Woolwich.
Sure. And I mean, in that sense, it was a difficult patch, and there was, you know, a certain amount of crime and that sort of thing that you had to contend with. I mean, you tell very, you know, personal story as well in the book of sad loss of a pregnancy by Annette.
She was beaten up. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was, I suppose, the sort of reality of the area, that sort of thing could happen.
Well, we lived happily at Thamesmead for 2 or 3 years, but because we were so on the job, it was just almost 24/7. You know, the work, there was always something. And so for a little while we moved off the site. We got permission to use our housing allowance, the same sum that was paying for our rent in a GLC flat. We got same housing allowance and diocese and permission to live off site, given that my job wasn't so much in inverted commas parish and pastoral. It was a sector ministry, if you like. And I mean, I still did exactly the same amount of hours at Thamesmead and just had a longer day. And one night I was in a meeting at Thamesmead. Annette was at home in Plumstead, a little two up, two down house. And she went out to get the washing in, and there was somebody in the garden who chased her indoors, beat her up, broke her nose, and caused her to miscarry. And, you know, I think he was a mad person. It wasn't I don't think it was a rapist or a burglar. I think he was just a mad person.
Yeah.
And I don't think they ever found him.
I mean, obviously you had a child at this point, but yeah, was to be in the end your only child.
Yeah,
must have been difficult to take, but also something you finally accepted. I mean, were you able to see sort of some sense in what was obviously a tragic story at the time?
Not an enormous amount of sense. Mm. It actually, we had a rough experience with the police over it.
Mm.
You know, I mean, Annette was taken into hospital where they sorted out her nose and maybe the miscarriage as well. But when she was back, when she was back home again, a senior policeman arrived, you know, to interview us. Not so much sympathy we felt as you know, we're very puzzled, you know, and whoever it was, the senior of the two said, "Well, I can't understand it." He said, "You know, this is the first time in 18 months that anything like this has happened on our patch."
Mm.
And he seemed more concerned about breaking his faultless record than my wife being beaten up.
Mm.
And I could have, never mind what I would have done to him. Anyway, we got used to it. I mean, we continued trying to have children right up until about 1980, I think.
Mm.
So they're just nothing but miscarriages, really. But
you, in the end,
you know.
Yeah. You. I suppose you have to sort of say, well, we will move on, and and in a way, you threw yourself into not just priesthood, but all kinds of things. I mean,
Yeah.
I read the book and I'm sort of left just feeling exhausted by the amount you ended up doing.
I tell you, if it's any comfort, it was quite a piece of work writing. I'm sorry though if it's wearied you.
Well, it's just you were doing it, what sounded like about three part-time jobs, amounting to actually more like, you know, two full-time jobs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you not only were looking after your parish and so on, but you got into broadcasting as well, and you started doing a communications job for the diocese and all sorts of things. So just talk us a little bit about that sort of period and particularly the broadcasting, because that obviously would come to define, you know, the latter years of your life as well.
Yeah, well, it's important to say that one of my last mad ideas for Thamesmead, and one of the nicest things and the cleverest things, really, most caring thing that was ever said to me, I think, at Thamesmead was, "Patrick, we're going to have to limit you to one idea a year." This was from Jim Thompson, who, you know, you could tell he was going to be a bishop. But he was a lovely man and died only 2 years into his retirement, which really was not fair.
Mm.
But he said, not because they're not good ideas, he said, but because of the consequences. And I know exactly what he meant, because any idiot can sit down and have a good idea. But then what? Well, one of my last good ideas at Thamesmead was the whole of the estate was cabled, because it was quite low-lying land. It was in the shadow of Shooter's Hill, and therefore television from Croydon Crystal Palace couldn't easily reach us. So the whole estate was cabled by rediffusion. And for years, I'd wondered whether we could have community television, you know, on the site. And one day I went to find out whether we could or not. And rediffusion said, "No, you can't." And I said, "Why?" They said, "The government won't allow it. And even if they did, you couldn't afford it." But they said, "Did you know they're looking for six mad people to start community radio stations on cables? And I think the closing date is tomorrow." So I raced back to Thamesmead, rang the Home Office, said, "I'm applying for one of these licences. Could you hold it open until, you know, the first class post could get to you?" And there wasn't time to talk to anyone about it. I just wrote a side of A4, typed it up, sent it off, forgot all about it. And to my horror, 6 months later, got a license and a bill for 1,000 and something quid. And that's how I sort of
fell into it.
But it grew up into a real radio station eventually.
Oh yes, absolutely.
FM license and everything.
Yeah. And I mean fast forwarding a bit, you know, you continue to get experience. You ended up in a job in communications for the Church of England, which led on to doing some training as well, again, in broadcasting, and eventually being involved in probably one of the most significant religious radio programs of the 1980s, Priestland's Progress. But for those who maybe aren't familiar with that, especially our international audience on podcast, Tell us about that and who you were working with and what that was all about.
It's all somebody called Chris Reese's fault. He was a tutor on the Cambridge radio course. He was a full-time radio producer across Radio 2 and Radio 4 in the 80s. And he and Gerald Priestland, who was a religious affairs correspondent, said, why don't we make a program about the Christian faith? Because we make assumptions all the time about what people know, what they think, what they believe, and we really don't know. And wouldn't it be fun to do it? And so the idea was born of 13 three-quarter hour programs. And we decided, or hijacked really, Gerald Priestland into being both the subject and the object of the of the program, which probably, you know, some thoughtful producers would run a mile from, because we used him as the pilgrim, and he went to every, and we sketched out 13 subject areas which he should, you know, immerse himself in. And he, I think they did about 100 or more interviews. They'd be about half an hour long. And these 50 hours of broadcasting were condensed down to 13 three-quarter hour programs. And they were hugely detailed.
Yeah.
Gerald Priestland was a journalist to his fingertips. He'd been the BBC's Washington correspondent. He'd worked in Vietnam, covering the Vietnam War. He'd worked in India, I think, as well. I mean, and he was passionate about English and passionate about broadcasting and journalism. You know, he had a marvelous thing on Saturday mornings, Yours Faithfully.
Yes.
Which was fantastically popular.
So he was, in a way, you know, a well-known figure in broadcasting at this point.
Yes, a trusted person.
Indeed. And this was going to be going out at a decent hour in the radio schedule.
Yeah.
And it reached, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions.
It multiplied the Radio 4 audience on a Sunday night by a factor of four times.
Gosh.
And a subsequent person who produced me on Pause for Thought, he became a radio producer because of Priestland's progress. He used to dash home from college, I don't know what he was studying, to listen to the weekday afternoon repeat, and that propelled him into radio, and it propelled at least 10 people into ordination, apparently.
Yes. Yeah. And it's fair to say that it was a pioneering sort of show, because it wasn't just a yet another stuffy bishop telling you about the history of Christianity.
We made very sure that we didn't interview stuffy bishops. that's why, I mean, it was very strange. This was another, shall I do it? Shall I not? And unusually for me, I said no three times to Chris Reese. He kept asking me if I'd be his researcher for the series. And I kept saying no, and it was a very sort of biblical story, really. Yet a third time he asked me, and yet a third time I said no. He said, why do you keep saying no? And I said, because I have this wild idea. You're looking for somebody who's organised, who thinks in straight lines, who is tidy and all of this. He said, and I'm none of those things, I said. He said, why do you think I keep asking you? It's because you're not any of those things that I want you to come and work. He may have told me that a previous person had a nervous breakdown. I found that out after the event.
He kept
but
that
anyway,
one quiet.
This was a dream, because, I mean, I'm not so good at theology that I haven't got lots and lots of questions to ask, you know. So I asked lots and lots of questions, and we devised this, in terms of, I was very struck by a book about how they teach theology at Harvard. And they had learned from the Faculty of Law, who used to just teach law, and then go from stuffy books and then look at real life. They turned that on its head. Let's look at real life and then see how the law bears on it. And the theology people picked up on this and said, let's not teach it in a stuffy academic way. Let's look at life. Let's see how theology and doctrine and all of that bears down on it. And that was that was what we were hoping to do.
And it had this extraordinary response. I mean, you read through about 17,000 letters.
Yeah, we got so many letters. We got a shelf full of books, little blue books of an improving nature, trying to set us straight about Christianity. But Gerald wanted me to screen out for him all the letters that he thought needed a personal and pastoral response from him. Mm. Which he attended to personally and pastorally. So that was why fetched up reading all these letters and ones which seemed to call for, a caring response.
Yeah.
Rather than what a nice job you made of that, or how on earth could you interview Spike Milligan? That's another story. And he worked at all those letters, that needed a pastoral response, he attended to personally. Yeah. That was the man.
Really interesting. I mean, there's much more that could be said about your further exploits in broadcasting. You were involved in Chiltern Radio and then local BBC Radio, and you did various outside broadcasts from the Greenbelt Festival. And, there was one episode where you just managed to get a broadcast out by the skin of your teeth I seem to recall. But so we'll have to skirt around that for the moment, because I do want to get to clowning as well. Which, and of course, the cover of your book, A Room Full of Elephants, has a picture of a clown on the front cover.
And the odd elephant.
But why clowning? How did you end up being one of the few priests who gets to dress up as a clown occasionally in church?
The Bishop of Hartford, who in about 1980 or so, Peter Mumford, he rang up one day, as bishops occasionally do. Patrick, he said, I want you to go on the mid-service clergy course 4 weeks in St. George's House, Windsor. I said, yes, of course. Didn't ask any about it. Of course I didn't. Just said yes. And, and of course, there's a catch, as there is with everything. The catch in this case was that everyone who was on the course before they went had to say what they were going to research and write 10 or 12,000 word paper on it. And that had to be in by a certain date before the course started. And that would, together with all the stuff we had from St. George's House, would form part of the study material. So, I don't know, 6 or 8 weeks before the course started, we were asked with our partners, wives, whoever, to go spend a day at St. George's House meeting the staff and finding out a bit more about the course and so on. And so I was shown into this study. My tutor was this very tall Methodist called Dr. John Long. Huge, imposing book-lined study, see, and sat me down. And he said, how's the project going? I said, what project? He said, well, he said, you were supposed to be doing... Oh, yes, I said. Well, and he said, well, what were you going to study? I said, the church and communications, but I've gone off that. I don't think the church is interested, actually. And there was this terrible silence. And he said, almost in panic mode, he said, well, what about music? You know, because time was running out.
Mm.
I said, well, I play the 11 or 12 string guitar, but I don't read music, so that's not going to work. And there was this long, deepening silence, into which I suddenly heard myself say, I know, I've always wanted to look at the connection between clowns, fools, and the gospel. He got very excited. I was very surprised because I'd never thought any such thing ever. This was pure gift. That's all I could say. This was God saying, how about doing this, you know? Oh, he said, no one's ever done that before. Tell me how I can help. So luckily, because I can write very fast, I did about 10 or 12,000 words and got it in, you know, just in time. And as a result, I mean, that's how I met Rowley Bain, the real clown priest. I mean, I'm only a sort of half clown priest, really. But he'd just written an essay or preached a sermon at Cudston about clowns and fools. So we got on like a house on fire, and he told me who I should go and see, people who were training clowns, you know, and people who worked in pantomime and so on. And I did a lot of very quick reading up about Shakespeare and fools in Elizabethan times and fools in society down the ages. And because I had I done? Yes. By then I'd done a sociology diploma while at Thamesmead, and which got me into all sorts of interesting studies. And so that had been a huge help. It's all preparatory.
And what I mean, obviously there is the verse about, you know, being a fool for Christ in the Bible. This is taking it very, very literally.
Dressing
up as a clown. What are some of the, you know, abiding memories, or one abiding memory at least, of you performing and but also, you know, bringing the gospel to people in perhaps ways that they would never have
dreamt
of it before?
We did quite a few visits to prisons, and going a little bit back, as a result of Rowley and I meeting up and my writing this gospel fool thing, this was picked up by an extraordinary organization in the States. They run, or in those days, they may still do, I don't know. They ran every year a clown, mime, puppet, dance and storytelling course, I think a week or a workshop, a week or a fortnight in Washington, D.C. in August. And as a result of my writing this paper, I got asked to go and do two lectures at this course. I think about three people came, you know. But for this, they paid Annette's flight, my flight, Stephen's flight to the States and back.
Wow.
And we bolted on another 2 or 3 weeks and,
went
to see friends and relatives in America. And across America then, there were 3,000 clown ministry groups. 3,000. Okay, so I learned a bit about that. And as a result, we tried to organize, we tried to get a group together in this country called the Holy Fools, which we did.
Mm.
It still sort of exists and it, you know, it still has a website and there's still clowning done, which is great. Now, what was your question?
Well, moments.
Okay, we did shows in prisons and hospitals and places like that, as well as churches. And we were doing a show in Wandsworth, and because I lived sort of 30-40 miles out of London, I couldn't actually justify the time to go and take part in sketches. I'm hopeless at sketches because I can't remember lines. I'm much happier improvising, which is the ruin of sketches. So I said, just leave me 3 minutes and I'll see what I can do. So I turned up with in my sort of clown gear and let into the prison, and one of our members was a fire eater. Still is, I think. And she said, oh, can you go and get me a drink of water? This was during the show.
Right.
This was happening in the prison chapel. So I walked across the stage, which you're not supposed to do, and found a glass and a tap in the vestry, because it was happening in the prison chapel. And my eye was caught by a bucket underneath the... and probably because the sink leaked. So I filled the glass with water, put it in the bucket, walked back across stage, didn't say anything. And as I walked across, people started laughing. Bear in mind, this is a prison. So when it came to my 3 minute spot, I just fooled around with this bucket. I started with it as a baby sitting on a potty. And I then became a toddler who picks a bucket up and plays soldiers and gets it stuck on his head and so on, you know, seven ages of buckets, really. And the more I did, and I didn't say anything, the more I did, the more the prisoners laughed. And I was too close to it. And I said afterwards in the pub, when they let us out, I said, what was that all about? And bear in mind, I'd been a prison visitor while at Lincoln. So I knew about slopping out. And all. They said, you fool, which I took as a compliment. You've helped people to laugh at something which is profoundly unfunny and awful.
Mm.
You've helped them to laugh at slopping out and having to have a bucket in your cell overnight and slop it out in the morning. And, this reminds me of the marvellous medieval joke, because most jokes are probably medieval, really, of a guy who's idly playing dice and death arrives in the room, you know, to have a game of dice, as in dicing with death. And the guy who's sitting there with his dice looks up, sees it's death, and says, oh, death, I thought you'd be thinner. See, now a little giggle. If you can laugh at death, if you can laugh at slopping out, it loses its power over you.
Yes.
You know, how did the Jews cope with Nazi, pogroms and the death camps and so on? When they were able to do so, they used humour. They used music as well, and storytelling, I've no doubt. And they even put God on trial in one of the concentration camps and found him guilty. on all charges.
Mm.
And, you know...
It's amazing that the power, yes, that something on the surface that, yeah, that looks just like entertainment, clowning, but actually it can reach people in ways that a sermon or other forms of ministry can't.
I think across a lot of doorways in Anglican churches, I wouldn't speak for other ones, probably in Latin, abandon laughter, all you who enter here, or something like that.
They're
not known. We're not known for a laughter in church. One of my favourite responses after a sort of Holy Fool's mission somewhere in darkest Kent was a very old lady at the door, because I did the sermon, and it was pretty riotous.
Mm.
I got them to do all sorts of wild things, like standing on their pews and becoming seagulls very noisily. Never mind why. She said, "I just wanted to thank you," she said. I said, "Why? That's very kind. But why particularly?" She said, "For reminding me that it's all right to be uninhibited in church." What a gift. Wonderful. What a wonderful response that was.
Yeah.
And I thought I'd blown it, frankly. No, but I mean, laughter, you know, I remember when I was broadcasting in Hertfordshire and Bedfordshire, we weren't allowed to play, the Monty Python song, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. I think laughter is a gift of God.
Yes.
No question about that. Humour is a gift of God. Storytelling, music. There's so many ways in which the gospel can be shared.
Well, you've shared it through that ministry. You've shared it through your personal ministry, through the broadcasting you've done as well, Patrick. And I wish I had more time, because I would have got the story of the pantomime horse that got blessed by the Archbishop of Canterbury out of you.
Oh, tell people to buy the book.
Yeah, exactly. I was just about to say that. But if you want to find out how Patrick got blessed as the front end of a pantomime horse by the Archbishop of Canterbury, you'll have to get hold of the book, A Room Full of Elephants, My First 80 Years in the Church, by Patrick Forbes, who's been my guest on The Profile today. It's been absolutely fantastic catching up with you, Patrick. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And your legacy will continue for a long time, because I know that Premier are hoping to rebroadcast some of these classic travellers' tales. Even my own wife was a guest on your travellers' tales.
Yeah, as a young, didn't get down to you though, did I?
As a young ordinand in the United Reformed Church at the time. But it's been an absolute pleasure to catch up, and all the very best. And perhaps we'll check in another 80 years time, Patrick.
That'd be great. Yes, I'm looking forward to it.
See what's happened next. And thank you for your reminder about the elephants in the room that do still exist in the church. I have to say that the book ends on a serious note, because you talk, in the end about the future of the Church of England. I think there's some really important things you have to say about the need for church unity and sort of getting rid of some of the baggage, perhaps, in order to make ourselves ready, for the future. But again, do find out more by getting hold of the book, A Room Full of Elephants, Patrick Forbes. It's published by Bohun Publishing. And I'll make sure there are links from today's show if you're listening via podcast. That's the easy way to get hold of it as well. That's at premierchristianradio.com/theprofile. But for now, thank you very much, Patrick Forbes, for being my guest on The Profile this week.
Thank you, Justin. Been fun.
Do come back again. Same time next week, we'll have another guest telling us about their life, faith and ministry.